My Family Recipe is a new podcast from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network, bringing you cherished heirloom recipes and the stories behind them. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that's him. It's gonna get you some.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, man. We're almost here on the end of spooky season. How are you holding up with all that?
Wait a minute. Is the end of October the end of spooky season? I thought spooky season was kind of like all the way up to closer to Thanksgiving or Christmas.
No, I think no. It seamlessly transitions from spooky season to Christmas. Like that's how it works now. it's the second that Halloween is over, when you're all waking up hungover at 11 a.m. on November 1st. That's when you got to go outside and take down all the inflatable crap that you have in your front yard. That's like the witches, the pumpkins, the skeletons, all that, and replace it with reindeers and Santas. That's. Didn't you get the memo? I think Congress passed that bill a few years back.
I am so out of the loop on this stuff. I will say this. I was in the grocery store just yesterday, and I noticed eggnog. But right next to the eggnog was pumpkin eggnog. So I feel like that's the bridge, right? We're crossing over. We're getting it out of pumpkin-y whatever season with pumpkin eggnog so we can move into standard eggnog.
See, I feel like this is our fault. I feel like because we just stood by when Christmas season just ate Thanksgiving, which used to be this nice DMZ between Halloween and the holiday season. Now we're having this encroachment of the holidays on October, which is too early. I had a similar experience. I put it on Instagram where I encountered pumpkin spice hummus.
Oh yeah, I saw that. That's spooky.
We've gone too far.
That was shocking. That was shocking to me. I have some news to report, and I think you're in the same boat. I went for the first time since March of 2020 or before, because I don't even remember the last time. I went to a movie theater and saw a movie in a theater.
What'd you see?
I saw the same thing everybody else saw. I saw Dune.
I have not seen Dune yet. I am out of the loop on Dune. I feel like, and not only have I not seen Dune, I've not read the books. I've not seen the David Lynch movie from the 1980s. I have no idea what's going on. So I feel very much like a boomer whenever I go on social media now, where I'm like, what are all these people talking? What is this spice thing everyone's memeing about these days? Well, I don't understand.
Well, help me out, Greg, the movie is set in 10,000 100 and something. That's the year of the movie. So obviously, it's pumpkin spice.
Of course, it's expected to take over the entire calendar year now. They added a few extras. All 14 months in the future are now, there was just 12 wasn't enough for the pumpkin spice. They had to add more.
Yeah, so spice in Dune is what makes interstellar travel possible. And it is also a highly addictive chemical. So obviously, it's pumpkin spice. They don't reveal that. They'll probably come out in the second movie. But that's what it is. It must be. But it was a great joy to be in a theater, to have a big screen, a bold soundtrack, some beautiful visuals. I'm not going to give any of the movie away. If you're a fantasy fan, you're going to love it. If you're not, you'll still love it. It's great.
If you go because someone else wants you to go.
I'm just very happy to be in a movie theater with a flask of Genever in my pocket,
Yeah, and like that's the I know that because I subscribe to HBO Max among 50 streaming services that I never use at this point. I know that I could just sit on my couch and watch it anytime, but I don't want to. Like, I love that experience of being
this is a big screen
in
event.
The movie.
I think you're cheating yourself on this one if you see it on a small screen. It, honestly, frankly, just for the soundtrack, you need to be in that theater sound, that's going to really immerse you in the event.
Yeah, and I think I've talked about this on the show before. I just love the actual act of going to a movie theater. And I think that people, we're in this big transition in the industry now with so much streaming options with, you know, Warner Brothers famously making that decision to release all of their movies on HBO and in theaters at the same time for this entire year and kind of keeping an eye on that experiment and seeing how it goes. You know, people were worried like, oh, are people not going to go out to movies anymore? And my answer is no, because of an experience I had 6 years ago when I saw Mad Max Fury Road in theaters. Perfect film. I don't say that lightly. There is nothing about that movie that is wrong and doesn't work. Like, I mean, it's not My Dinner with Andre, but it's not trying to be My Dinner with Andre. It's trying to be a 2-hour chase scene through an apocalyptic desert, and it is perfect at that. And there's one scene that goes on for about probably 20 minutes, and it's a real nerve shredder. And at the end of it, the music fades and the screen goes dark, and there's about like maybe 2 seconds of total silence for the first time in the whole movie. And everyone, like, I saw this in a crowded theater, everyone had been at the edge of our seat for like this entire time. And in that silence, you just hear one guy in the theater go, "Huh!" And then everybody laughed because we're like, yeah, we're all with you there, man. We're all there. And that is why, I don't know, I love actually going to the movies. I will always love going to the movies. I will always love bringing a flask of Negroni to the movies, like I did when I saw Venom 2, which I also very much enjoyed. And just that act of, you know, we're social creatures. That's why we want to be back in bars. That's why we want to be back in offices, even perversely, some of us. And it's why we want to be back in movie theaters, because we want to have these pleasurable experiences, not in a vacuum with other people around us.
Yeah, indeed. 100% agree. Well, speaking of carrying things around in flask, who we got in the virtual studio with us today?
Carrying around best, in our...
That's my best segue ever.
in our little flask of a virtual studio. I kind of feel like I'm in a flask right now. Honestly, I'm just in this little tube that I've of a closet that I've outfitted as a podcasting studio. Yeah, so joining us in our virtual flask, we have Jen Querbes of Brandy St. Louise. Jen, thank you so much for sloshing around in here with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan and I'm just thrilled to be here. So thank you.
So where is your flask sized studio? Where are you coming at us?
I am in Dallas, Texas.
Now, when I think to myself, Brandy, the first thing I think is Texas.
Obviously.
I get that a lot. Yeah. Pretty clearly.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about why you're in Texas.
Well, I'm actually a first generation Texan. Oh. It's a big deal here. But the rest of my family, everyone I'm related to is from Louisiana. That might make more sense to you. So my family's from New Orleans. Like I said, I'm first generation Texan. But so my grandmother, all my family grew up drinking Sazeracs, originally made with cognac. And, a lot of those original New Orleans drinks, as well as the historic pre-prohibition ones that we're all familiar with, were, as you know, about 2/3 of them were originally brandy based. And New Orleans was epicenter for that, I would say, in the U.S.
Of course,
so,
yeah.
That's kind of where it all comes from.
And where is Brandy St. Louise located?
It's just me, so.
Is wherever you are, but no, where is production happening?
Production is in Cognac, France.
Okay, great. That's what I was driving towards.
Yes, yes. It is a French brandy, but it is. Technically a French brandy because about 10% of my fruit comes from, is Uni Blanc, the grape from Grand Champagne within Cognac. But the vast majority comes from right outside the region of the AOC in southwestern France, also Uni Blanc. So that's why it's French brandy versus Cognac.
Right, of course. I'm a pretty big fan of brandies in general. I love American brandies. I love cognacs. I'm a big fan of Armagnac. Mm-hmm. So I'm super stoked to have you on the show and talk to us about it and educate us a little bit more about the category as a whole. And of course, talk to us about your mark. What got you interested, other than your sort of familial upbringings with being around the spirit in New Orleans, which where I lived as well for several years, so they tell me. what moved the needle for you to leap into becoming a maker?
Well, I've always wanted to be a maker. Well, since I've been in the industry, I'm going to date myself here, but it's for many, many years. about 15 years I've been in the industry working for other brands on the, you know, on the floors of distilleries, you know, as a national sales managers. I've done startups, consulting, you know, just pretty much everything in between. And I wanted to start my own distillery at one point. I moved back to Texas. I wanted to make rye down here in Texas, but, I kind of realized through a lot of my friends that had been through this, that I was going to need a lot more money and a lot more time than those resources either one that I could afford. And I wanted to see if there's any possible way to avoid getting investors because I just didn't want to work for anyone else. I wanted to be able to do what I wanted to do. And so I asked an old friend of mine who was an importer. I said, maybe there's something to this importing thing. Let me learn about that. So I called my old friend John Troya up and ended up working for Tempest Fugit Spirits for about 3 years. And also I was the brand ambassador.
A brand I know and love and trust. Love Tempest Fugit stuff.
The feeling is mutual. Last time I saw you, Heather, I was with John Troya up there in New York it was right around the election. Oh God, it's been four, five. Well, man. It has to be since.
Jennifer, time has become meaningless in the past 19 months.
Well, anyway, and then I was the brand ambassador for Hein Cognac, so I had some experience there. And then when I was running around to illustrious bars in such as yours, Southern, in New York, and in all over San Francisco, Austin, Chicago, everywhere. I learned a lot more about cocktails working for Tempest Fugit, especially the historic cocktails. And I did a lot of research, and that's when I found out that about 2/3 of the original pre-prohibition, pre-phylloxera cocktails were originally brandy based. And I was like, why have I not heard of these? And these, you know, and then they went with all these punches and all these applications. Why do they use gin in French 75s now instead of cognac? And then I realized phylloxera, you know, wiped out the vast majority of the vines in Europe. So not only could we not get any from that standpoint, but then prohibition happened. And, you know, World War I, too, we weren't trading. And so for those reasons, some rye whiskey was available from Canada. Gin was being made in bathtubs around the country and other places. So they got, in bourbon and was in the U.S. So naturally those kind of just slid in where brandy was before. And I just really questioned that and wondered why. So I did a lot of research and kind of development and tested on those cocktails with cognac. And I found also that cognac, and a bunch of bartenders and people that were more familiar with this than I was, noted that cognac typically gets overpowered in cocktails and is not usually cost-effective to put in them. I'm obsessed with cognac. It's lovely. It's fabulous on its own, but really it's not necessarily intended for use in cocktails. So I found a kind of a big hole a big need in the market for that. And I didn't want to ever make anything that was redundant. We don't need another Fruit Loop vodka or anything. Nothing flavored.
One is enough.
Right.
One's too many. Yeah.
Good. I don't even know if they do that anymore. I've seen it. But anyway, so I really wanted to do something that was not a vanity project or was not anything superfluous. I really wanted something that there was a need for. So then I set out to accomplish that. And then from all my time that I had spent in the region of Cognac, I had some contacts there and we worked on different flavor profiles. And then I brought back different iterations of different blends and then worked with bartenders to assess the performance in cocktails as well as the flavor profile on its own. So and then I brought back my little iterations and I bring them to the bars and we try them all and just kind of see how they stood up. And then we experimented with ABVs from 40 to 46%. And it really turned out that 43 was really where I love it on its own, but it stands up in cocktails without overpowering the other ingredients in the cocktails, mm-hmm. and even possibly in elevating the most desirable attributes of the other ingredients in the cocktail. So,
yeah. And I love that you designed this with such a historical bent in mind. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I was so pumped to have you on the show today, because you and I are both big history nerds, and especially mm-hmm. big cocktail history nerds. Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned, a lot of the classic cocktails that we're used to today that we think of as like dialed in as whiskey cocktails, like the Sazerac, originally made with cognac, the what we now know as the old fashioned, was the default assumption was you made that with brandy. And even, this is my favorite, the mint julep, which is like the bourbon-iest bourbon drink that you could possibly imagine, originally peach brandy, believe it or not.
Yeah, so I love it.
I love that like you said, this is a spirit that people don't really reach for to mix with, because I think, you know, we got out of practice, and then our American tastes, as American tastes tend to do, gravitated towards bigger, crazier, stronger, weirder flavors, and you lose a lot of that subtlety of, you know, the cognac cocktails that perhaps would have existed in yesteryear pre-phylloxera. So mm-hmm. it sounds like kind of your mission was to almost create this historically minded brandy that could be used and pay homage to all of these old drinks, but also that had a little extra, you know, 21st century muscle behind it, so it could really stand up and you would sip it and be like, oh yeah, that's not rye, that's not bourbon, that's not gin, that's brandy right there that I'm tasting.
Wow, that very, very well articulated. I can say it myself, but thank you for translating.
It's like, yeah. It's like I talk for a living or something.
Yeah. Greg's really pretty good at radio.
You know, and something that also you just pointed out too, with the bigger, bolder flavors, it's so interesting to me that people, especially talking about right now in the fall, coming in the fall and the winter, and all the amazing brandy applications there, but people think of brandy as, you know, a cold weather drink with a cigar and a snifter and all that. But at the same time, and so people are like, well, you know, a lot of consumers I wasn't really even familiar with the category until relatively recently. You know, I'm not trying to ever talk down to anyone, because there really is such a lack of information, a dearth of information, education on the category out there. I'm trying to, obviously my life goal and pursuit is to get it out there. But when we were talking about those bold flavors of whiskey and bourbon and those, people that drink old fashions all summer, but no, brandy's just for the winter and fall. But brandy's it's much more delicate and subtle. So I'm really trying to, especially I'm in Texas and also throughout the South. You know, it's hot. You can have a sidecar or really anything that you do with whiskey, you can do with brandy, and it's actually a lighter spirit. It's just it's distilled wine, which is sort of not really out there as, you could make brandy from any agricultural product, pretty much. But, I just, the seasonality is something of it that I just, really want to, I just don't understand why. I'm just trying to bring it back in the summer as well, but they are really good ones.
One of my favorite dive bars on the planet is a place called the Red Derby. It's in Columbia Heights in Washington, D.C. And I don't know if they still do this, but for a while they did sidecar Sundays where they like sidecars were on special. I think they were like $6 and they served them on the roof in a plastic cup with a sugar rim. And I put away many, many of those in my early 20s, but it is like, it's a crushable drink. It is not the sort of thing that you have to like, you know, have out of a snifter in a leather armchair next to a roaring fire on top of a rug that used to be a bear. Like it's a drink that you can crush and enjoy and have in, you know, on a roof in lighter mm-hmm. times when you're being a little naughty on a Sunday night.
Exactly. And like we were talking about juleps.
Yeah, for sure. And my last trip to France, which was again in the before times, I was there in summer, which P.S. is the worst time to ever go to France. None of them have air conditioning, which is not the worst thing, but none of them have ceiling fans, which are, you know, I lived in New Orleans for a long time and it's hot there. I didn't have air conditioning, but I had ceiling fans. But all we drank the entire trip was cognac Schweppes, you know, just a which is how they call it there, but it's just, you know, cognac and tonic. And, you know, very bracing and refreshing and summery. And I don't think that it's about the base spirit of your cocktail. It's about your cocktail. An old fashioned, yeah, that dictates maybe that leather chair and the bear rug. But a brandy sour, that says summer to me. So I think brandy's definitely, I think all spirits, but certainly brandy can easily transcend seasonality. On that note, let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. We're going to come right back and keep talking to Jennifer from Brandy St. Louis. Stay tuned.
Good food is worth a thousand words. This is Aarti Menon, and I'm delighted to share a new podcast with you, My Family Recipe, from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network. Adapted from Food 52's much-loved column of the same name, the My Family Recipe podcast will bring its pages to life. Each episode of My Family Recipe brings you a cherished heirloom recipe and the story behind it from voices across the world of food.
We'd open these tubs of dough and they would exhaust these incredible yeasty fumes, and it just smelled like nothing else. It was so intoxicating.
I'll interview writers and chefs, parents and children, about what's passed down along with the foods that we know and love.
Chinese people aren't like born with a download on how to like velvet chicken. You know, like that's not something that just like comes to you.
Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back. You're listening to The Speakeasy here on Heritage Radio Network. Today we're talking with Jen Querbes of Brandy St. Louis. And this is actually, if you're enjoying the sound of Jen's voice, certainly probably more than the sound of my voice, this is your second chance today to hear Jen on a podcast talking about brandy. Isn't that right, Jen?
That is correct.
A little while back, you and I actually met because you were on an episode of my other podcast, Backbar. The episode that you're on launched this morning. It's about the history of women in cider making and distilling and the weird sort of telephoned history of the name and the recipe behind the Jack Rose cocktail, which is also a really fascinating story. And I really wanted to talk to you for that episode because, as we said before the break, you make a very kind of historically minded brandy, but it's also, you know, I found your story as a founder really fascinating. And even the name of your brandy pays tribute to a fairly important woman in your life. Isn't that right?
That is correct. My grandmother, I called her Mommy, but she's Louise Robinson Querbes, my same last name. So yes, I named it after her. Again, she was actually born in Dallas, lived here for 5 years, about four blocks away from where I live now. And then she moved to New Orleans when she was five. And she loved her Sazeracs and her French 75s and Vieux Carré, but I did it in honor of her in that regard, and also from New Orleans, but also in tribute to women that have been sort of, that weren't really able to pursue what we are able to pursue today. And I remember when she passed away, she told my dad, I just feel like I didn't accomplish anything in my life. She's like, she raised children, she did everything, but they couldn't, you know, go out and found a spirits company and go and do what I do. So this is sort of a tribute to honor, but they did do a lot that we don't, as we discussed on Backbar, that, you know, women were involved. We just weren't, it wasn't documented.
Yeah. So. And that's one of the really interesting things that we actually brought our mutual friend, Jessica Graves, founder of Violet Crown Spirits, who is a wonderful distiller and a wonderful, it turns out, podcast co-host to go host the episode with me.
I know, right? New York tomorrow.
She is.
Oh, that's right. She will be here in New York tomorrow. Oh, man. Yeah. We'll have to do a little live stream of our two-person launch party for the episode when she touches down at LaGuardia. But yeah, like that was one thing that we were really interested in talking about is the fact that, you know, it's not that women didn't have a role in making these things. In fact, we talked to another guest who's been on the show, Dr. Nicola Nice, who said that, you know, it's not that women didn't write cocktail books. They were writing etiquette guides. They were writing, you know, home cookery books. They were writing these, you know, books that were considered very much for the domestic sphere that all have cocktail recipes in them. Some of them, a lot of them, much more practical than what you'd find in a bartending guide, but no one actually looked at them and said, ah, this is a cocktail book. So they all sort of got edged out of that history, which is a really interesting thing that we got to explore with your help, Jen, on that episode.
I mean, what an honor to have been included with those amazing women on there. It was very surreal when I saw everybody else that was on there. I was like, well, it kind of surprised me.
It surprised me too. I was like, wow, this many competent people want to talk to me. I was like,
please.
Do they know who I actually am?
Of course. No, that was amazing. And Nicola and I have known each other for a bit now. And wow, she's just really incredible. She's an amazing person.
Learned a lot from her. Great guests, great episode. Very intensely proud of it. And thank you, Jen, for being a part of it.
Thank you.
But yeah, I love that, you know, we tracked this history that gets to a point where someone can, you know, we've gone from in just two generations, a woman who can't found a brandy label to you who not only chose to found one, but said, you know what, I'm not going to do an American brandy. I'm going to go to France. I'm going to build in a really big extra step for myself because I want to hear it in your own words. What was the thought process there, and what has been the, was it as challenging, more challenging? Was it a total breeze? Like, how does it live up to what you're expecting when you set that goal for yourself?
Well, I honestly, like I was saying before, I mean, I didn't have to build a distillery and get money to build a distillery.
That's true.
I didn't have to get a cooper. I didn't have to get barrels and age it myself. Like I don't have that overhead. So, and that's what kind of really saved me through the pandemic as well. You know, everybody thought, and to bring this sort of back into it, but you know, everybody asked me, oh, you're in the liquor industry. You must be just killing it after the pandemic. And I'm like, did you run out and buy an overproof French brandy as soon as the shutdown happened?
Well, I did, but
there were a few people that did, but generally that wasn't the first thing that people were going for. So, but I'm trying to bring that back. And hope, yeah. So, yeah, that was fun times. I forgot why I even brought that up, but, I start a distillery. And so going over there, the Cognac House I'm working with, has been around longer than the United States of America. So they pretty much had it down, and I just could not be more proud of the way that this turned out, but I honestly cannot even take credit for it because this amazing product, because all I did was follow tradition. I didn't try to reinvent anything. I just did exactly what they have been doing for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years in the exact same way, with the exact same fruit, the exact same families farming the land, the exact same family that's distilling in Cognac. When I asked the distiller how long his family's been distilling, he laughed at me. Ah, you Americans, you always talk about time. As long as there's been time, my family distill. Okay. All right. Right. So he's been distilling since the beginning of time.
It's a different view of the long game.
Yeah, right. I didn't have to hire a distiller. I didn't have to do any of that. So, you know, and then since it's, you know, I capitalized on the economies of scale since they already had, you know, they're already, Cognac House already producing and they already are buying, you know, large amounts of glass and materials at the same time. So really that was sort of the easiest part and such a joy to go over there. But I wanted to be historically accurate. And the difference, I love American brandies as well. And I just love, I really want to, like we were talking, Damon and I were talking about collaborating in many ways, you know, especially from the education standpoint, because we're not, American brandy is just very different. In America, we are, you know, in the US, we're all about innovation and new and what can we do? And you know, in the old world, brandy and France, you know, it's all about tradition. This is how it's done. This is, you know, this is the way we do it. And in fact, you know, there's not even a word for brandy in French. It's just cognac or armagnac or calvados. There's not.
Wow.
So mine, I guess in some way is I bring a touch of innovation in there, being the American than I am, but by the overproof aspect of it, and also by sourcing my fruit a little bit outside of the region. I mean, some of it comes from just right outside, like across the highway. the terroir, the AOC designation. So it's exactly the same, but that highway, on the other side of the highway, that's brandy on this side. So I think that's my little touch of innovation. But I really love American brandies, but typically, you know, they'll put a little spin on it, like aging in sherry casks or bourbon or you know, a little American touch on there. So I just did more innovation. So that's sort of the difference. Also, it's more cost effective for me to source fruit there since I get it outside the region. Uni Blanc is, as you know, not everybody's cup of tea for, it's not a great drinking wine on its own, but it's, as you know, it's perfect. The acidity and dryness of it is makes it perfect for cognac or brandy production. So in the import part, it's pretty challenging at the moment with right.
I imagine the choice to do a blend of grapes that are coming from the AOC and some that are not is somewhat financial, but I bet that there's on the American consumer side, I bet that there's an advantage to that, which is you can't put the word cognac on your bottle. And I think that cognac is a polarizing word for the American consumer. Mm-hmm. When you say cognac, I think the American consumer thinks opulent, expensive, as Greg described, sipping in the leather chair with the bear on the floor. You know, whereas if you just say brandy, we're a little bit more like, oh yeah, let's drink this and have a good time, maybe make some cocktails and hang out, right?
That's a good point. That's a really good point. Well said. Yeah.
Like definitely. I think it sounds counterintuitive, but I'm imagining that it's probably a little bit advantageous here.
You know, I never looked at it from that perspective, but yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, you know, I think it's my years of experience in dealing with bars that are simply polarizing to people. You know, I had a hand in, of course, Amoria Margot. I had a hand in a place that served almost exclusively gin. And now I have a bar that's only tequila and mezcal. I have a bar that's absinthe and champagne. Like, I'm out there trying to just anger people, I think is what my career goal is. get them upset.
Love it.
Putting people in a jar and shaking it and seeing if they fight. But I, again, it's just these little, it's nomenclature and it's how we use the language. And I think that to not have the word cognac on the bottle might be an advantage in America. I don't know if that's
especially close. Up in Minnesota, Wisconsin.
Sure, right?
Brandy drinking people. Mm-hmm.
Right. The brandy old fashioned reigns supreme. Oh, yeah. It is the coin of the realm. Because I was going to ask, you already answered it, but I was going to ask, why did you choose to use grapes that are, quote, just across that highway? But I'm sure it's both financial, and then I thought of this as well.
Well, I have access to just far better quality than of fruit than I would be able to have access to within the region at a fraction of the price also.
Sure.
Because
those lines are those lines are arbitrary, right? I mean, they weren't going out and doing scientific soil samples, you know, hundreds of years ago when they decided where these lines were. So it's likely the very similar soil, very similar water runoff, very similar sunshine. Like, you know, it's just a line. It's just a line we drew.
Mm-hmm. And with the microclimates within the micro terroir, you know, within within cognac is also very, very different. So, you know, and this is just really. Right there, some of it comes. I do get some of the grapes from Armagnac as well. There's a little bit from there. Also Uni Blanc. So it's sort of a hybrid between, I would say, cognac and Armagnac, but with the exact production of cognac. So it's double pot distilled, aged and blended there in the cellars in cognac. So, but really, this, you know, and. You know, cognac is just like we were talking about. It's a delicate, lovely, beautiful spirit. This, my brandy, I'm not, although I love it on its own, and it's that, but it's, this is more of a sort of, I was going for like a workhorse versatility, just across the board, plug and play, put it in whatever, any recipe, especially the historic ones, and it's going to stand up and it's going to taste just like it did back you know, 150 years ago. So last, yeah.
Well, I love that. And I just have to ask, were you greeted with any skepticism? Like, I'm just imagining, you know, this French family that's been making cognac since like the Cretaceous period, just kind of like, you know, mm-hmm. working in their vineyard one day, and this Texan comes up to them just like, howdy.
Blonde Texan. Yeah, that's me.
Have I got a business pitch for you?
You know, I think that's my biggest accomplishment is convincing them. I just still can't believe they picked me because they don't do it for anybody else. And it's just quite an honor. In fact, my cellar master was pretty thrilled about it. I knew just from previous industry experience, I'd known the house before and the employees there. So I was familiar with him, but he actually loves working with Brandy because he's been first, you know, I guess he's fifth generation, the cellar master. And he has been confined by these extremely stringent and restrictive rules that designate cognac for so long that now he's like, oh, I can do this and I can do this. And we're experimenting now with different varietals that have not, as far as any of us know, been done in France ever before. And, you know, just aging them, seeing how they're going and just seeing what happens. And he loves it. He's like, this is just, he gets to be creative. And
So what you're saying is you're over there being a bad influence. you're stripping them away from the tradition and making them innovate, which is what we do here in America.
Yep. But then, and you know, what's so funny is a lot of them, like, you know, some of the cognac houses I've noticed are modernizing their labels to kind of bring it into current times. Whereas I used a label that was an Armagnac label from 1837 and customized it. And they were like, why do you want to use this old label? Like, and, right. You know, it's just funny. We really romanticize it. And at least I do, just, you know, history and everything all the treasures they have over there and the way they want to be modern. And it's just, it's really interesting. Grass is greener.
Yeah. Grass is always greener on the other side of the hill.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited to get a hold of your stuff. And that was my next question. You've only been launched since 2018, you mentioned. Where in America are you available? Because, you know, our listeners are very familiar with the fact that the rules are different in every state. So it takes a while for things to roll out. Where can we find you?
So the first year, I'm actually in about, I think, 35 states now.
That's incredible.
Thank you. that was probably my hardest thing, especially during the pandemic. So on my website, which is Riku Spirits, RICOU, spirits.com, I have most of my retail on there, but then definitely all of my markets. But, you know, I'm not in any control states other than Oregon. You know, for a small brand, it's hard to get into some of those. California, New York, Texas, Louisiana, Georgia is actually a really good market for me. Kansas, Florida's killing it. I mean, all my markets are incredible. Minnesota, you know, it's also really very well. I mean, anyway, now I'm going to leave out some DC. I just launched in DC last week and I didn't know this before, but it's the number one cognac market in the US. I think that is a snifter situation, though. I think that might be.
like outstripping the brandy old fashions of the Midwest? Holy cow. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah. So it's just really
crazy. DC, baby, it's full of surprises.
But it's really crazy to see what people are doing with it, from Miami to San Francisco to Arizona. Like, you know, of course, in Miami, a lot of people are making, I've seen a lot of riffs on pina coladas. With my brandy, and it's just incredible, the versatility. That's something that I really, which I should have from all the research that I have done, you know, the category and with all the vast array of cocktails that it was historically based. you know, but it, just to see what people are doing with it now, it's just the versatility of it's just incredible. So on our website, it's there. Retail's on there, and then also we just added an e-com edition there, which is amazing. So you can buy it through my website, through the website. It's actually, the price is pretty good, cost effective for cocktails. and if anybody can't find it, one woman show over here, I answer all the emails, social media, everything. And so I'll help you find it, do the best I can.
Awesome. She is the call center.
I'm the janitor, the call center.
You know, that's simply how it starts, you know? Yeah. You're married to it in the beginning.
Oh yeah.
And hopefully it's a great relationship. But you're getting a lot of notice from people that we know and love and respect.
Wow.
Pop Cult and the Difference Guide both give you high marks.
Thank you.
You've won a couple of gold medals from various things. So you're out there making good juice, it seems. We just got to get it into people's hands so we can prove it to them.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll get you all bottled ASAP.
So again, I would drive our listener to Riku. Is that how I pronounce it? Riku Spirits?
R-I-C-O-U
spirits.com. You can easily be found on Instagram as well at Brandy St. Louis. That's BrandyStLouise, one word, Brandy St. Louis. We'll have all that on our Instagram post as well and in our show notes for you to go check out this stuff. Really appreciate you spending your time with us today and dropping some knowledge on us about old world, new world, and making brandy from Texas in France. How about that?
Thank you guys so much. This has really just been quite an honor and a pleasure. So. Thank you.
Always a delight talking shop with you, Jen. Thank you so much for coming on learning us about some overproof brandy.
Anytime.
Yeah, can't wait to get a glass and start mixing up some drinks with it.
I can't wait for you too, Souther. Let's do it. Cheers,
absolutely.
Y'all.
Oh, in the meantime, that'll be it for us on the Speakeasy this week. Tune into heritageradionetwork.org for many more amazing shows just like this one. And if you want to become a member of the HRN family, just click on the beating heart at the top of our homepage. That's it. Till next time, everybody. From me and Souther and Jen and Damon, cheers.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.